everybody. My name is Henry Mendez. I work at Tablet Hotels. It's a strictly BSD shop. I'm a systems administrator there. I've been building computers for a very long time. It's a lot of fun, and hopefully this talk will encourage someone to go home, buy some parts, build something themselves rather than buy from at a store, or just to have some fun with something to do, you know, on your free time. So this is a network area and storage from scratch. I'm thinking I'll be covering general purchasing tips. I'm going to go through actually the physical construction of the entire machine, so from unboxing boxes to putting everything together. Common pitfalls that I came across the way, things that are commonly mistakes when you're building a machine and setting up services. I'm going to go over the hard drive setup, so how I set up RAID, how I'm going to configure the disks, and service configuration. So I'm going to be using ZFS and NFS toward the end of the talk and help you or show you how to configure those services to get quickly up and running. So the first thing to do is know your requirements. So you have to, whatever you're building something, it's for a storage device or maybe something for the office, is a couple, three things. Pick your budget, how much storage space you need, what are you actually looking to do editing. Is it strictly backup, or are you going to be streaming media off of it to your home PC, or you're going to have five people connecting to it, just yourself, or, you know, a whole office. Also, how redundant do you want this to be? Is this, do you care about if you lose all your pictures of your kids? If you do, then you know you're a horrible parent, but that's how it goes. If you care about this stuff, you want a redundant disk, then I'll help you how to set this up. So the requirements for this project that I had was about 4 terabytes of total space. It needs to be very redundant, and it's going to be frequent wipes. This hardware was, I built this for a friend of mine who has a home office. He does 3D rendering, and he has terabytes of models that he uses, and he writes this all day long, so he needed something that he could rely on every day. Can you guys read this all right?
Yeah.
All right, cool. So the part list that I used for this, I used 4 2-terabyte SATA drives. These are going to be used just strictly for the storage, and I used 1 hard drive for the OS. I'm not really too strict on being redundant on the operating system. If it fails, you can replace it, and you can always remount the data. It's not that big of a deal. You don't need very much performance parts for a storage, for a network storage device. So the CPU I use is Intel Pentium 2.6. It's a very low power usage CPU. It's possible you can really use CPU that much. It's very cheap. Motherboard is just a Gigabyte motherboard. I recommend the brand. It's pretty good. It has some nice features to it. Power supply, 750 watts. After I did this build, I realized it might have been slightly overkill on the wattage for this build, but the SATA card that I picked for this supports up to 8 hard drives, and I want my friend to at least, if he needs to rebuild his box, at least most of the parts you can reuse for a long time to come. Just a general purpose video card, it's like $20 or something. 8 gigs of RAM seems like a lot, but since RAM is so cheap, it doesn't really matter. 8 gigs, I mean, 2 or 4 gigs would have been enough for this box, but RAM is cheap, so it doesn't really matter. The RAID controller you use is an Intel-based RAID controller. Oh man, I can't really read that from the bottom. All right, sorry about that. Toward the bottom is an Intel RAID controller. It's actually kind of expensive, but the throughput through it is actually very good, and I didn't want to sacrifice any performance speed on it.
Is that a hardware or software RAID controller?
It's a hardware controller. So it's a hardware Intel RAID controller. And at the bottom is the Leonie ATX mid-tower case.
Because you need the ports, or because you're using hardware RAID?
Mostly because you need the ports and to use hardware RAID. Hardware RAID is way more performance, has way more better performance over software RAID, and if you use software RAID, you usually stuck to what's stuck on the whatever SATA ports around on the motherboard, or you have to buy some external card anyway. And this card supports up to 8 SATA drives at 6.0 gigabits. It got really good reviews, and the performance when I used it was really good. So these are our parts that we're actually going to build something with. We can see we have, this is kind of the fun when everything arrives, you get to unbox everything. So first we're going to unbox all our parts, and we're going to have our case. So if you can see, we have our motherboard base plate where our motherboard is going to attach to. the slots on the right are our hard drives. I picked this case because we can stick a ton of hard drives in here. It fits up to 8 total, which supports up to the amount of RAID control it can. So I thought that was a good feature. And after that, the case that I bought, Lee & Lee, is a good brand. They make really good quality stuff. The aluminum is really good. It's very easy to work with. I've bought some cheap cases over the years, and I've many times had to hack Dremels and stuff to get everything to fit. It's not uncommon to hack up a case. You're going to get a bunch of various screws. It's common with any case. You'll see when as we go through. So the first thing we're going to install is the power supply. It's a 750-watt power supply. Most modern power supplies are very modular and configurable nowadays. Each of the cables on the bottom isn't actually attached to the power supply. So if you don't need six power cables, you can only have to plug in one or two of them or however you need, which is really nice. So to install, on this case, the power supply usually should go first. Sometimes if you have a case, you should put the power supply last, just because it makes, when you have all your motherboard and everything, so it makes it very difficult to work with. Things get really tight really quickly with all the cables and everything wired in. It's very simple. There's usually 4 screws on the back of the case. You just kind of screw them in and line them up with your power supply and you should be good to go. Sometimes the power supply is located at the top of the case, so you're going to have to support it and hold the screw in. It's not rocket science. And here we have it installed toward the bottom of the case. As you see in the other picture, we have our hard drives on the right. The next, we're going to install our motherboard faceplate. These generally come in different configurations. You just pop them into the back of the motherboard case. One common thing is that these things are very, very sharp. I've cut my fingers many times. Be careful when you're handling these things. Anything in these cases is made of very sharp metal. So watch your fingers. They're tight to squeeze in, but they do fit in here. All right, here's our motherboard that we're going to install. Common motherboard, ATX style. Oops, thank you. First thing about knowing about installing your motherboard is line it up on the base plate before you start pulling and installing the screws. So there's these screw holders that I circled in R in yellow here. So put your case down, put your motherboard down first and kind of eyeball where they are and then put these screws in, because there's a lot of different holes, a lot of different configurations to install these with. If you miss one, sometimes it's not that big of a deal, but you kind of want your motherboard to be supportive, especially when you start pushing cards in. There's going to be some flex in the board. You don't want flex in your motherboard, you're going to break something. Here we have our motherboard installed. It's just line it up. Sometimes you're going to have to, if nothing really fits perfectly at anything you build, you're going to have to twist a little and line things up and struggle a little. It's just normal part of the process. One big thing is when you're screwing in the motherboard, do not over-tighten the screws. You can just kind of tighten up until you see it's about not going to turn anymore. If you over-tighten, you can put a lot of pressure on the board here. When you move the case or anything, it's very easy to get these hairline fractures, and you won't know why your motherboard is not working or something isn't working. And very common is you put too much flex on the board and it broke. Here's another view of the motherboard. Another thing is, if you over-tighten your screws, don't strip them. If you strip the screw holders, it's a really pain in the butt to get everything off again. You're going to have to use pliers underneath it, unscrew it. It's a huge pain in the butt. So next we're going to install our hard drives. Depending on what case you get, every hard drive, how you mount them on a case is going to be different. This case came with nice screws on the side that kind of have these little rubber mounts, and you kind of slide the hard drive into place, so there wasn't really much screwing. I just had to screw into the hard drive and slide it into place. It makes pulling out and pulling in really easy. It's just a nice feature of the board. And as you see, here's where we're going to install our hard drives. As you can see, it has the slot for it. And the hard drive kind of just slide into each one, which makes it really easy to replace and to work with. And here's the other side of the case. Here, two features we have is a cable tray on the right side that kind of carries the jumper cables, which I'll show later. and two fans that in the front of the cases are going to blow cool air into the hard drives. And here we have our hard drive installed in the front. See, they just slid right in very easy. You have five going, I can fit two more, and then two more above it if needed, but for this case, I didn't. And here's the other side. We have them lined up with the connectors facing towards the back. So here's, now we have to set the jumpers on the board. This is not very fun. You're gonna have to read your motherboard manual and line up and read how to line them up. You should get like a flashlight. It's very tricky. They suck no matter what you do. Sometimes, I'll mention later on, it's very hard to tell which is the correct way to go. They have little markings on the jumpers, but they're really, really small. And if you got fat fingers, it's really hard to get everything in there, but it's just something you gotta live with. Here's another angle of them all. As you can see, it's very, very tight and very, very small. It's working, the fingers are blown up. Another feature of this case was front USB 3.0, so I just shown here how I plug that in. You might not have this, you might, just something to notice. The next thing we're going to install is the CPU. The only thing to notice on this picture is the four holes surrounding the CPU, and that's where our CPU fan is going to go into. To unlatch the CPU, there's a little arm over here on the right-hand side, kind of pointing to it. Just unlatch it. It's very tight. It seems like you're forcefully doing it, but it's fine. It's supposed to be extremely, extremely tight. This installing CPU is not very difficult to deal with. There's one very important feature they need to know is that it can only go in one way. On the CPU socket, it's notched or sometimes labeled with a little arrow, and on the CPU as well, there's a little golden arrow on the corner of each CPU. If you don't line this up right, sometimes if you have a cheap board, it might seem like it'll fit, and you're putting it down, and if you forcibly close it, you're going to cause damage, and you won't realize that the CPU isn't lined up correctly. It's just a thing to note. So here we have our CPU that we're going to install. And here is the golden arrow that we're actually looking for. Remember, line this up with the notch on your CPU socket and you should be good to go. If you haven't opened up a box in a long time, you'll notice that modern CPUs don't have pins anymore. Pinless CPU, so don't be surprised, oh no, this is broken. I don't know how long anyone's built a box. And here we have it installed. As you can see, we have our hour facing up, and it's lined up properly. Depending on where you guide, the closing mechanism is going to vary. It's just a metal plate that covers over, and you latch it down. Next we're going to install is our CPU fan. Sometimes if you buy, depends on what CPU you buy, this will come with your CPU or not. It's very important to make sure that you check the part list on your CPU. Does it come with a fan? If not, or else on the day you're opening everything, you have all the things and you have the CPU fan, you need to run to some store or buy one online. Most OEM fans are pretty good. They're not the best, but for this case, it doesn't really matter for performance and cooling wise. They're not the easiest things to clean either, but you know, they come with the board, they come with the CPU, it's okay. They're pretty easy to install. You just have to line them up on the four holes that were around that I showed in this picture. Installing Intel fans is somewhat of a pain in the ass. The mechanism isn't like that great, even though, you know, the hardware engineers, you know, are very smart over there. You never really know if they're lined up, if they're really in properly. You have to really push and twist them in. It's kind of a tricky mechanism. Also on the bottom of the fans, you should note that that's where your thermal grease is that goes on top of the CPU. Don't touch it. It's going to get over your fingers. It's going to spread. If you touch it, it's going to get dirty. And you don't want that stuff to get dirty. If you do end up touching it and wiping it, I would generally say wipe it off completely with some alcohol swab and reapply. You don't need any more thermal grease than what comes on fans. If you get a fan that has thermal grease on it, some people think, you know, that the thermal grease isn't good enough, or they want to buy their own super cool Max, whatever they see on Newegg for $12 or whatever. You don't really need it, but if you do want to do it, you can still buy it anyway. My only suggestion is don't over-apply the thermal grease. You just kind of really need a tiny amount. It's better to under-apply than over-apply because when you push the CPU down, the thermal grease is going to squeeze out all around to the sides. It's going to dry up. It's going to cake, and you're going to have a mess in your hands. And it's also a very pain in the ass to clean. Next, we're going to connect the fan power connector. This has, through this cable, you can control fan speeds on your motherboard, so you can set settings like if you want it always on or off on, you know, lower speeds on different temperatures, whatever you want. It also powers the board. And you're going to have to look on your motherboard. It's usually close by. So we can locate on our motherboard where it is usually labeled, but also you can look on your manual where it is. And here we have the fan and CPU installed and the power connector. Alright, next thing we're going to install our video card. This is a nothing special video card. It says no performance at all. It was like a $19 card. It's a PCI Express, a PCI Express slot. Again, this motherboard, since it has a cheap CPU, it didn't come with onboard video, so that's why we had to get an extra video card. So we're going to locate our PCI Express slot, which looks like it's usually labeled on the board. As you can see here, I kind of crossed over it. But the modern PCI Expresses are a little bit bigger than what you're used to. The older ones are right underneath the regular PCI Express. And then we're going to install our card. So installing any type of network card, audio cards, video cards, very simple. You just have to line it up and press down. So you hear some clicks. The best idea is to put it on, kind of put your thumbs on the front and the back and press down so you hear a click. It should be pretty firm. It shouldn't be loose. You shouldn't be able to tilt it one way or the other. If it is, that means it's not fully secure, and you're going to want to make sure it's tight in there. If it's not tight in there, when you start moving the case around, it's going to start popping out, or when you install your monitor in there, you're going to feel it's going to be moving out, and you're going to unplug it, and you're going to have to open up your case and get back in there. So next, we're going to install our RAID controller. Very similar to installing the video card. Again, I picked this RAID controller because it supports up to 8 hard drives. It has 2 main channels. Each supports 4 cards. As you'll see, I'll connect the cable in the next couple slides. So we're going to find our PCI Express 8-speed slot, and we're going to press firmly until it's snugged in there. And here we have our card fully plugged in and ready to go. So here are the cable connectors that we're going to connect into the RAID controller card. Each of these cables supports up to 4 hard drives. So we're bypassing the motherboard hard drive connectors. So all the hard drives are going directly into the SATA controller, the RAID controller. And I'm only installing one because I'm only using, I'm maxing out this slot on 4 hard drives. If you ever want to install more, you could use the other slot, which is why I decided to get this card in the future. Next, we're going to install our memory. Memory is pretty easy. Just make sure it has a red heatsink, because red is like being super fast, so it's always good. Make sure you look at the pictures. This is our general 240-pin DIMM. It's very simple to install. We're going to locate our memory slots on the board and install. The only thing with memory is that the motherboard, depending on how many DIMMs you have, is how you need to and what DIMMs you need to install the memory in. Obviously, if you have 4, you're going to fill them all up. But if you have 1 or 2 or even 3 DIMMs that you're installing, you should read your motherboard manual and line them up accordingly. Sometimes they're usually offset by 1. They're going to be labeled like A, B, C, D. And if you have 2, it's going to be 1. You're going to have to install 1 in A and a 1 in C or any configuration. And that's what I'm showing in this slide. So I'm showing the space in between them because that's how they recommend. Installing the memory. Why they do that is because memory channels are split across. So you just split across in pairs. So you're not sharing the channels across the motherboard. You need some better performance. Next, we're going to install the power cable. This again only fits in one way. It's usually keyed. it doesn't seem like it's going to fit. It's not going to. It really only fits in one way. Don't force any of this stuff. If you force stuff, you're going to break it, and this stuff is very, very easy to break. As we're on power, we're also going to connect the CPU supplement power. Not all CPUs have this, but most modern CPUs have supplement power. This is a very easy thing to forget. If you don't have this in, you're going to get a lot of strange responses from your computer. It's going to turn on. Maybe it's not going to turn on. It's going to reboot. You're going to have a whole bunch of wacky situations here. So it's an 8-pin connector, so we're going to locate it on our board, which is, again, usually pretty close to the CPU. Can't tell where it's located from this picture, but when the next slide I kind of zoom out and you'll see it. So here we have things kind of getting together. You can see where our rate controller is. It's kind of the bluish cable toward the bottom. That's where our cable is going to go to our hard drives. You can see we have video card installed, and we have our CPU supplemental power, which is going from the power supply all the way up near the fan at the top left. And we have our memory and our CPU. So we are almost there. Next is the very fun stuff. We get to install our DVD drive so we can install our favorite operating systems on there. Super easy. Find the hole that it fits. Screw it in. Not that hard. But the only trick is, again, these flex tapes are very sharp. Sometimes they're screwed in. Sometimes they're not. So you kind of have to take the case apart on the side to make sure. Sometimes they don't feel like they're screwed in. They are, and you're trying to pull it off, and you're just going to rip the metal, and it's going to have a nightmare on your hands. It's just two screws on the side. The only thing that you want is slightly over-tighten the DVD drive or CD-ROM drive, whatever you have, mostly because they vibrate at very high speeds. And after a while, if you don't tighten these tight enough, the screws are going to vibrate, and it's going to come loose, and you could have some shaking in your DVD drive. I mean, usually know this if like from a laptop or something, but when you're building stuff at home, you have to kind of be aware of this stuff. I've broken some CDs by not screwing these things at all, and the thing will vibrate and it'll shoot a CD out of the drive. It's fun, but you know, not fun replacing it. Here we have these are the blue cables that go to the RAID controller. They are labeled, 1 through 4. I'm just connecting them into the hard drive that I'm going to use for the RAID setup. I try to label them 0 through 4 from the bottom to the top, just so it's easier. So when you come down later on, it's like, oh, what, drive 3 failed. Like, oh, well, is it drive? Did I actually label it correctly, or did I put the cable in correctly? So just kind of be mindful of what you're doing and how you cable things up. The next is we are going to install the operating system hard drive cable, and that's going to go straight into the motherboard. It's not going to be RAID, so we don't need to plug it into the RAID controller. Now we're going to install the power on them all. This is where things are going to get a little bit tight on you. The cables are going to start to really pile up, especially with this mini hard drives. You got to really do your best on getting everything lined, kind of really get to fit in there. Again, nothing fits perfectly, so you're going to have to mush cables around. Sometimes you might even have to flip your hard drives around to get it to fit properly. And in this case, we're kind of showing the cable mesh that we have on our hands. So we have all our power connected to. I also have our exhaust fan powered up. I also don't have a picture here, but the two fans in front of the case also need to be powered. So don't forget to power those on. They're not super essential. Not every case has them, but they're nice to have, especially when you're running this mini hard drive. They run hot, so it's nice to keep them cool. And here we have our finished product, which kind of shows everything that I went over, has everything connected all together. And here we have the front of our case, very dark and evil looking. And then we're going to hopefully power this thing on. And if we get power lights, success. Success equals beer. Take a break. If you don't get power, well, now comes the fun part. We're going to just troubleshoot some of the things. The common things that we have is it doesn't turn on at all. Completely dead. Or you get no video, which is probably the trickiest one to troubleshoot. The easiest one to troubleshoot is various tones from the motherboard, which usually mean You know, you're missing a CPU, you're missing memory. They're very easy to distinguish. Or a constant reboot loop. If it doesn't turn on, you could check your jumpers. Sometimes the jumpers are set incorrectly, so double check them. That's why I said to make sure that they're, you know, you read the motherboard manual and make sure they're in well. Sometimes it's easy to just flip the jumper over around. You have the ground mixed up on the jumper settings, so just flip them around. The same thing goes with lights. If it turns on and you don't have any LEDs, common thing is just flip the jumper around and your LEDs will come on. Make sure your motherboard has power. There's usually a green light or some sort of indicator on the motherboard that actually has power. If it doesn't have power, now you could potentially either have a bad motherboard or B, a bad power supply. How are we going to test the power supply? If you don't have like a voltmeter at home, I don't know if anyone does, but if you don't, an easy way to test the working power supply is kind of, well, it's a bit of a hack. All you need is a power supply and a paperclip. You're going to bend the paperclip in like a little U shape, and there's one green cable that you're going to look on the power cable connector, and you're going to plug one end into the power cable connector, which is the green cable. Every power supply only has one green wire on it, which signifies power on. And then you're going to look for any black cable. There's going to be multiple black cables on there. That's just the ground, so don't worry about it. Just pick any black cable. Once you plug in the power supply into the power, it's going to turn right on. If it works. If it doesn't, then it's a good way to test you have a bad power supply. And don't be scared about touching the paper clip. It's not going to like electrocute you or anything. So it's not that big of a deal. Also, some people don't like to do this because they think it's scary. It's really not that bad. It's a really easy way to test the power supply is working.
Facebook is not liable for anything.
The worst that will happen is you'll get a little shock or something if you have a really good paper clip. You know.
Have your kids do it.
It's not too bad. Have your kids do it. This is the one I learned when I was a kid. No video. This is a very tricky one to troubleshoot sometimes. Very rarely I've come across where it's actually a bad video card. It is the case. But usually it's either it could be bad memory that's not configurable with the board. It could be even a bad CPU. Also, if you don't have all the power connected, if you forget the CPU supplemental power, this is a very common case that you won't get any video, the box will turn on, and you won't know what's going on. So it's a very tricky one to troubleshoot. The best thing, if you can't figure out what it is, take each individual card that you installed out one by one and turn it on. It's a pain in the butt, but that's how it goes. So in this case, we had to take our RAID controller card out first, turn it on. If it doesn't work, take the video card out, turn it on. If we get some more tones from the motherboard for the video card, like, okay, well, now we have a bad video card. If that's not work, memory, CPU, we got to go through the whole cycle. Various tones from the motherboard. This is usually signified, the motherboard will complain to you when you're missing gear. If you're missing memory, the motherboard will yell at you a certain way, it'll give you different various tones from there. If you're missing CPU, it'll be the same thing. So if your CPU is incompatible or your memory is incompatible, it's going to give you these various tones. So your memory might not be bad, it just might not be compatible with your motherboard. So always when you're buying, make sure everything is compatible. Reboot loops. We've come across these a bunch. Sometimes it's overheating, which could mean either you forgot your power to your CPU fan, and the CPUs get very hot very quickly, and the machine will reboot after a couple seconds. Also, if you don't have enough power, the machine will constantly reboot. So if you bought like a 200-watt power supply, and you have, you know, like an Intel i7 in there, and like a bunch of, you know, fast hard drives, the power supply won't take it. And the motherboard is going to complain, it's going to be constantly rebooting. Okay, so now we're going to get to the software side of things. I'm going to go over how I set up the disks and the services to get this thing actually on the network and actually usable. For this setup, I chose RAID 10. This is a good performance and good redundancy. Because I care about data loss on here. If we have a hard drive to fail, it's not a big deal. Performance still won't struggle. You can even lose up to two as long as it's not in the same pair. That sometimes happens if you're lucky. A failure happened in a different pair. If not, then you're out of luck. Most RAID controllers have command line interfaces, so you can control all this stuff either through the motherboard to the RAID controller interface. Right when you power on, it'll say hit Control G or Control I to enter the interface, or through your operating system, you can control this stuff while your system is running. So you want to reboot to change anything, you can change the RAID controller on the fly. With Intel, I'm not sure which it is. I couldn't find one that supported this card. But if you have like a three-ware or a three-com RAID controller, there's a command TWCLI, which is a nice tool to have. And you can, you know, modify your RAID hard drive, you know, whenever you want. It's very nice to have. It also tells you when a hard drive has failed, so you don't have to guess, which is very nice to have. So what we need to get this configured to actually get on the network. So I chose to use ZFS and NFS to get this going. Some people are haters of NFS. I don't know why. It's pretty good performance over the network. Support across multiple OSs. If you have this at your home, you can get, you know, your Mac on there. You can get Linux or any of your BSDs. You can get your Windows box hooked up there too as well. Windows is a little bit trickier, and I don't know how to do it, but I've heard rumors that you can do it. It chose ZFS not for its redundancy or its ability to set up Z-arrays or anything, but mostly to be able to control the storage space a lot easier. It's nice to set up storage pools and snapshots. Is everyone familiar with ZFS and its snapshots and its abilities? Some of you? Well, ZFS is pretty much a talk on its own, so this will maybe be like an intro to ZFS. Maybe I'll give a talk later on and how to actually use ZFS in a much better way. Anyway, it has a lot of good capabilities. It does. It's easy to just have backups on this thing. So this machine is not as a backup server. It's just mostly just to store data safely. If we were to send. If we ever needed to back up the server, it's very easy since we have everything in one big Z pool. We can just use a nice feature that ZFS has. Actually, you can send a file, an entire file system, to another machine either over the network or locally, which is a nice feature to have. So first, we're going to set up ZFS. As I mentioned before, we are going to create one big Z pool. You can split this up into multiple pools if you want, name them different ways. You can set quotas on them. You know, if you have, you don't want to overfill your disk, or this is for like a small office or something, and you can set quotas on this so, you know, users don't overfill your hard drives and cause any other problems. It's very easy to get up running. All we're going to do is use the command zpool, and the syntax is very easy, so it can be zpool create. Your pool name, you could name it whatever you want. It could be storage. In this case, I named it pool 1. And then the device name. If you're using a hardware RAID, the device name isn't going to be SDA or something like that. It's going to be usually be DA, which will be for disk array. Some CFS tunings that I'm using here is I'm turning compression off, and I'm turning off A time, and at the bottom, I'm just enabling it in rc.com. These are little performance things to help ZFS along. It's not the fastest of file systems, but it's not this unusable file system, and you need, you know,
ZFS doesn't need A time?
No.
Well, I mean, okay, I know with UFS with A time, I know when not to use it, when I need to use it, when I don't, but when it comes to ZFS, I mean, isn't that type of metric necessary?
I mean, it all depends on what you're using it for. If you're using ZFS for its, you know, file system checking capabilities, then yeah, you should maybe have it on. And so, like, same thing with, compression, I don't think I've left on, but it depends. This all just depends on your setup. Again, this is just setting up just so you can store stuff over the network and a more going for performance.
Well, I know it can help performance.
Yeah.
The question is whether you actually need that.
I don't think you actually need it, depending on your setup, if you turn it on or off. Also, if you have a very low-grade CPU and not much memory, another tuning you can set off is set off a checksumming. It's not recommended to do, but if you're really struggling with ZFS performance on like a really cheap box and you have a ton of hard drives, You can turn ZFS checksum off as well, and you get a little bit extra performance boost out of there. At the bottom, it's a little bit hard to read, but all I have to edit, this is on any BSD type box, OpenBSD, FreeBSD. You edit etcrc.com, just do ZFS underscore enable equals to yes. That way, so when you boot up your box, ZFS will auto mount your file system for you. If not, when you boot up your machine, ZFS is not going to be enabled, and you're just going to have to do ZFS mount your file system.
RC local,
huh?
Well,
is
anything except previous even have it yet?
Have it yet? No, they use RC local. No, not yet. That's what they've always used.
No. Is there anything except previous even have it yet?
You can install it. You can do it in RC local if you want to be like an annoying SA, and the person behind you comes like, "Where does this guy sell these configurations?" You know.
Previous people for open for net.
Well,
also those systems don't have ZFS.
Yes.
Okay, so FreeBSD only. My mistake on that. Next up, we're going to configure NFS. NFS is three pieces, which is probably the most. So in this whole setup, this will probably be your most frustrating bit if you're not too familiar with it. Again, we're going to edit rc.conf, and we're going to enable NFSD. We're going to enable RPC bind and mount D. NFSD services the requests from the NFS clients. RPC bind allows their clients to find us on the network and be able to query the exports file. And Mountie passes the request from NFSD to the clients. So it's kind of a three-service system here. I'm also setting permissions pretty, as you can see, the permissions are pretty lax on my setup here. I recommend really lax permissions when you're first setting up. Very common mistake is you start setting restricted permissions at first, and now you can't get anything working, and things aren't mounting, and you're getting permissions errors, and you're not sure why. And this is a simple setup to try to get everyone up and running really quickly. I would read up on proper NFS permissions afterwards you get up and running. Once you're actually connected, you can restrict things later as you go on. So how to configure NFS is very easy. We're going to edit the exports file. The syntax is very easy. We're going to put the directory that we're actually going to share. At this case, I'm giving, and then the options you're going to give it, and then the access you're going to allow it over the network. So you can be pretty restrictive. You can allow only a couple IP addresses. You can allow certain usernames or certain group names. You can even do read-only access on it if you want. In this case, I don't want read-only access. I want full rewrite access, and I want the whole /24. The all DIRS option on here is so you can mount any subdirectory within this /4/ pool one. So I have pool one music and pool one movies or documents. You can mount them each individually on the client side, which some people like to have to organize things a little bit easier. And then all we're going to do is start our services. So we're going to start RPC bind, we're going to start NFSD, and we're going to start mount D. It's just starting services like you do on any box. Yes?
There's this caveat that I ran into with the NFS configuration. If you don't specify map to root, it will map requests from root to nobody, leading to some unexpected behavior. Map to root is something worth mentioning here, I think.
I generally...
Am I wrong?
Tell us about it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, as one of these, like, anti-fidgeting mechanisms, by default, NFSD will translate requests from UID 0 into nobody's UID. Nobody, the theory goes, doesn't own anything on the file system, so you can't do too much damage by accessing the file system to nobody. That awaits the case that you might want to do that, though. There are a bunch of cases for accessing NFS as root. And so you would do hyphen map root equals root, call it a root, like say the wheel, to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you can set the restrictions to be up. More stricter, more lax as you go. I mean, for the first setup, I always try to do as simple setup as possible. I mean, this is a working setup, and you can mount it without specific user groups or anything on the local machine. That's why I gave this example. But I mean, there's a whole slew of other options to give an exports file. And that's a good one if you want to be more restrictive on things. And then we're starting our services, which is RPC bind and the NFSD and mounty start. So troubleshooting NFS. The most common problem is permissions. That's why at first I always said, really like permissions, try to not be too restrictive. If you can't, so the first command to check to see if this is all working is on your client side. You can do this on Mac. I don't know how to do it on Windows or Linux or any other BSD. There's a show mount command, and you can do show mount -e, the IP address of the machine that has the NFS mount on it, and it's going to return a list. It's going to see export list for the IP address and what it's actually sharing. So here it's saying 1.102 is sharing /pool to this network range. And if you have a misconfiguration in your exports file, like say you typo the directory name, or you have the network too restrictive, or you typo the network range wrong, you're going to have to reload. You're going to have to reload mount D every time, just so it reads the config file. Again, these rules are just so it's very simple to mount on multiple operating systems without having to have a UID or a GID on the NFS machine. And that's all for me. Any questions?
What happens when the rate controller does?
You're shit out of luck, man.
Does that have to be that way?
It doesn't have to be that way.
What could we do? Your battery and your...
You could replace a rate controller. I haven't come across too many rate controllers. I haven't been at shops out long enough to see a rate controller fail. Do you have any suggestions?
About every other week.
Huh?
About every other week at NYM.
And you guys have some shitty rate controllers.
Oh, no. We use software rate. We're smart. I'm talking about customers. Every other week.
I don't know what you either are buying, but if you buy decent gear, it shouldn't die.
Everything you can imagine.
You know why I want to hire you as the hardware buyer, that's why you said.
Oh, no, we don't.
See, my response is that all hardware dies, everything breaks eventually. You know, it's just for performance-wise, this is more performance than anything. Software RAID is generally slower, and for this case, I'd rather not use it.
It's about within that neighborhood these days.
It is, but also if you're on... Depending also what gear, where you install in this. If this is for your home, not all software RAID on your motherboard is any good. I mean, if you want to fit something in a, you know, in a server grade case and you have a rack at home, then that's cool. But if you're trying to fit like an ATX style motherboard in your house or something, or like in a small office, the software RAID on those motherboards is going to be pretty much useless. It's much easier.
If you're thinking about pseudo RAID, I'm talking about software RAID, like using the RAID features of ZFS, for example, or GeoMirror.
You could, but you asked a very general question. If you're using ZFS, then you could use that. I mean, I use ZFS RAID in some of our production machines as well. It works well. You don't always have to use
RAID. What I'm getting at is the nice thing about that is that you're not tied to the depth of this particular proprietary piece of hardware known as the hardware RAID controller. Your ATA controller can die, but that's fine. ATA controllers are ruthlessly standardized. You can just remove the disk into the whole machine. If the whole machine dies, then you've got your data. That's the nice thing about it. That's the reliable thing about software RAID. That's what I'm getting at.
Okay. I mean, there's pros and cons on both sides. I mean, you could argue that any piece of hardware can fail. That's what I think. So,
on that point, with controllers, the configuration is actually on the drives too. So if you blow your RAID controller, you replace the RAID controller, when it comes up, it sees that there's a configuration on the disk, and you can import it rather than the RAID controller.
Yeah.
Most modern RAID is definitely not hardware RAID, definitely. It's all
about this. Well, this guy has hand up first for you, sorry.
I have a couple questions. Suppose you were, I know you built this for your client for data purposes.
Yeah.
Suppose you wanted a NAS for backup purposes. I noticed you only have one OS disk. So what happens when the OS disk fails?
In this case, if the OS disk fails, I'm more worried about the data than uptime. So uptime is not a huge deal here.
Right.
So that's why I only chose one. And there's also a budget. This is another thing for a budget. So another hard drive is another, you know, 80, 90 bucks. So we're trying to kind of keep it, you know, a budget on here. You can do multiple. You can do redundant operating system. I mean, that's great. If you want for uptime and redundancy, then yeah, definitely go that way. But if you're on, you know, like on a budget and you care more about your data than uptime, then you know you don't really need it.
Okay. Second question. So you're protected within the RAID cluster for disk failures. What about like site-specific failures? So if you want to bring a disk off-site, let's say rotate a disk every month, is that doable with this kind of stuff? Because let's say your basement's plugged in, the NAS is in your basement. If you want to keep a disk every month, you just plug it in, build out the disk on that, and then swap it out.
Yeah, you can do that, especially in this case if you have ZFS running the file system. The only thing is that you'll need, if you want to replace a hard drive, like, you know, you want to keep it, like, you know, in the attic somewhere for, like, an emergency, the only thing is that the hard drive needs to be the size of the file system that you're backing up. So, in this case, we have 4 hard drives, and the max total space is 4 terabytes. So you're going to need, like, a 4 terabyte drive. In this case, we need a 4 terabyte drive to back up that entire file system at once. If you have a much smaller one, if you have like, you know, a terabyte, it's much easier or much, you know, more affordable. You can take a snapshot of the entire file system with ZFS and you can send the entire file system that you have supported on the RAID controller or any other RAID system that you have. You can send it to that hard drive very easily with 2 commands, and you can unplug it and take it somewhere else. I mean, that's pretty common to do. I mean, for off-site, you know, if you want to make sure that you have your data multiple, it's always good to have multiple backups. So in this case, we don't care about uptime because this machine is actually backed up to multiple external hard drives. So that's why it's always, you know, just know your own requirements before you get into something. That's pretty much my response.
Could you put your list of hardware up again?
Sure will. Somewhere toward the beginning. I'll find it this way easier. Is that up? For some reason, this comes out really light on here, but I have the RAID controller at the bottom. If anybody wants any of these pictures or any of this information, I have it all. I can give it to you guys. I can put it up on the website. Of the actual hard drive list, of all the actual part list and everything, and prices and everything. Did you want anything else? And you can come up here later and read. It's probably easier to read on my laptop if you want to write them down or anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the things, since you're using the FS, one of the things to know is that there is a DFS tuning guide on previous CVE. You definitely want to size your memory correctly, because otherwise you will eat all of your memory with just disk buffers. And that will make your machine unhappy. ZFS is extremely hungry for memory. So there's a tuning guide online. If you just search for ZFS tuning guide for DSD, you'll find it. And you should read through that, in particular with the ARC tuning recommendation.
Okay. I've come across that. In this case, I didn't show it, but that's a good symbol to mention and have. And ZFS is very memory hungry, so if you have, you know, a terabyte or so, you should use 2 or 4 gigs of memory. Just depending on, just because of the CFS features and stuff. Anybody else? Yeah.
How about going with a bare bones setup in lieu of building from scratch? What do you think?
Bare bones is in what?
As in, you get the box with the motherboard, you throw in the RAM, you throw in the hard drives, and it's the case is tuned to the motherboard. You know.
You mean like some combo view would have had the case and motherboard all coming together. Yeah, I mean, again, the part of this is there's many options. It depends on what you want to do. I mean, I don't, I built a couple of those. Those that kind of come on board, they're generally pretty inexpensive. The only thing is that they're slightly, depending on what size you have, like if you get like one of those like mini ITX cases that can like, you know, set up like a shoebox, they're very tight to work with. And you have very limitations, like you may be only able to get like fit like one hard drive in there. You won't be able, or if you want to use it for, you know, media, you'll be able to fit like a good audio card in there to put it to like a surround sound system or something, or if you won't be able to get a full card in there. I mean, it all depends on what you're trying to do. I got nothing against small cheap. I have one myself, a very small cheap box to keep underneath, and I actually have, this is actually from our friend, but my own personal use, I have 4 hard drives and it's all just ZFS. I don't use any RAID controller because it's way too expensive. So I have done, you know, all sorts of types of builds, and you know, whatever's in your budget, whatever you're trying to do. I mean, I'm just trying to push people to build your own box. You know, don't go to J&R and buy a laptop just because it's cool. You know, it's kind of fun playing with hardware every once in a while. You know, I try to build around like maybe 2-3 boxes a year, I used to build one like every 4 or 5 months when I was young and had no expenses.
2 or 3 times a year versus every 4 months.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on running like free NAS companies?
I don't have too much experience with free NAS, so I can't really comment on it. I've used some you know, off-the-shelf NAS devices. They're generally okay, but they kind of throw this big, you know, web interface and GUI on top of it. It kind of makes it slower, and you don't get as many features. I mean, if it's for like, you know, this is like an rack mount. If it was for a rack mount, it'd be something different. But you should just do research on it and whatever you want to do. I mean, they're just slightly slower, and they're more pain in the butt to work with, in my experience. I use ReadyNAS.
I think FreeNAS is, I mean, the way it's changed since like IX got off, I mean, it's just been tremendous. I think it's actually brilliant. It's brilliant. The beauty of it is not relying on your disks for the OS. You know, that you're running off a CF card or whatever, and you're wasting disk space. Maybe it's only, you know, 30 gigs, but you're wasting disk space when it comes to it. And it, you know, in whole lots of contexts, it simplifies things to such a degree. We don't have to, I mean, you know, if you're throwing things in someone else's hands and you don't want to maintain it, you know, free NAS PS cents are, you know, godsends.
I'll make one comment on that. I built a 2-bay box about 2-3 years ago. I thought I was going to problem with free NAS, but it actually turned out it was actually pretty nice. This was before it split, before things took over. The problem I had was with the actual 2-bay case. It was very, very difficult to get the 2 drives in. It was much tighter than a normal cord. And it was difficult to get the OS loaded. It was a compact flash SAN card.
Uh-huh.
So I had to plug in an external C drive, install previous CD onto the SAN card. That part was tedious because the hardware was so tight.
Yeah, I mean, that's usually what you get with something off the shelf. It's usually just slightly more trickier to work with because we'll just have some, you know, some robot or...
My main motivation for having that small little box was since it was running in my house 24/7, I just wanted to reduce the power consumption.
Yeah.
In the end, the hassle was kind of worth it, but...
Now you DP the image to CF.
What size of motherboard was it on there?
I don't know. I have to look. It was like a mini ITX kind of...
Like about like 6 inches or so?
It was great for a year until I dropped a weight plate on it, so don't put these things next year. Next year, weightlifting fan.
You just took away your authority in your comment.
I mean, there's a bunch of different options to buy cases and stuff, so I have a little mini ITX case myself. It's, you know, about the as high as my laptop and, you know, about this size, and I have, you know, 5 hard drives, and it's tight, but it works, and it's very low power use. The biggest power consumption is the hard drives on there. It's just, you know, nice to have at home to store some pictures, movies, whatever, yeah.
Yeah. Really using smaller drives, literally physically smaller, like laptop drives.
You could use those too. I mean, the only tricky thing is mounting them. You'll have to get creative. I mean, you can create your own. Not every case supports multiple of those 2.5-inch size drives. You'll have to create your own. It's not too hard. I mean, if you know, I'm not too scared of with a Dremel and hacking cases together. I've done that. I held the hard drives together with cardboard pieces because I had nothing else. As long as it's stable, the only good thing about the laptop drives is they're a little bit more durable. You can kind of tap them. If you're moving this thing around a lot, they're usually pretty good.
What about power consumption?
I mean, they're lower power consumption. The only thing is laptop drives, you're getting a little bit less performance out of them, generally. And they're also, for size, they're a little bit more expensive.
Also to watch out for the terabyte, the current lot of terabyte-sized laptop drives, because they're all just a bit thicker than most things. They have a real hard time fitting in.
You don't have
hammers? Yeah, hammers at home. That's all.
I mean, if you compare prices, like I bought 4 2-terabyte drives for this, and if you were getting them from laptop size, I mean, they'd probably be double the amount of money.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just... You know, if you're just buying like 1 or 2, then that's not a big deal. I mean, they're good space. The only thing is mounting them more than one is usually slightly tricky. I mean, but I mean, that's the fun of it, is just trying to screw something in together and cutting things up. Yeah?
I built this NAS 10.5 terabytes chip on the adjustment setup controllers, about $15-$20. $650 watt power supply, which your calculator makes it was fine. I'm not sure. I got an error, super block zeroed out upon reboot. Have any idea about that?
We could boot to CFT.
Boot what?
Boot to CFT. You have to write the first sector in the system. Mm-hmm. To format the disk for the beginning of the off.
No, no, but I mean, so it was working. The ring was working. Plus the software ready. And I opened the computer, I turned my car, and it was zero.
That was your first mistake.
That's where the GPL is.
That's coupling. It's different OS, or OS's.
I never came across that, so I'm not sure.
It might just be because the first sector in the MBR are written, so it doesn't know what to boot and how to boot it. But then it might actually be other software config stuff.
It was zeroed not on the OS drive, on the RAID drives, it said.
Or they just decided to drop the RAID drivers in the current kernel you were using?
There was no update. It was just...
If it was working, you could have, if you get your RAID controller, it could have...
a RAID controller, it was a static controller.
Oh, a static control?
Off the RAID.
Yeah, that's why the other thing I don't always recommend.
Yeah, this is the vibration.
Those aren't always the best. I don't know what motherboard you use, but generally the SATA controllers, those software arrays on there, they aren't the best. You can have a problem with it.
No. So I used the motherboard came with four controllers. I added two cards. And I used the software array that comes in there.
Software array on Linux. I'm not sure.
The AMD and KVM.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't really much experience with Linux on that stuff.
Do you have much experience comparing it to what you're doing using USB? I've talked a long time about all this, but I've got a lot of like USB enclosures that I use, and they're dollar slow, and they're glitchy. But as far as like, can you compare the dog slow glitchiness of my totally acceptable? Personally acceptable situation to what you said.
Yes. The reason for building this machine was that my friend had four external hard drives, and he was backing everything up to four external hard drives. They were not the fastest of things to transfer data over, especially when he's doing it consistently. And for his use, it was mostly, he just wasn't getting enough through with USB, and they were also not reliable. So his backup solution was one hard drive was backing up to the other, which was backing up to the other, which was good. But if you're doing constant writes, every time it rushed to one, it would back up to the other. It was more back configuration, but also the USB is just slower, and this is not that great. And it's also tedious to have these cables all over the place. You're limited to, if you just have a laptop at home, you're going to be connecting all these USB drives to your laptop. This one only has like two. If you have multiple drives, and then you got to lug your external USB drive here where you go around the house. Like if you want to back up your laptop from your bed or something, you can just connect something over the network and send it over. I find network is way more reliable than over USB drive.
I would actually, would you find that your setup, even using cheap hardware with all of the SATs, just using all of the onboard SATA controllers, find that to be more reliable and faster than USB? In general, with these big slow drives?
In general, even if you buy like cheap hard drives, like $30, $40 hard drives and just about safe, it's generally more reliable than the SATA drive. The biggest thing is things fail somewhat often, depending if you buy like a decent company. Things also, that hard drive is enclosed in this tiny little case and you're always moving around. It just has a more probability of a failure. And also you're actually bound by the physical USB connection that you always have to, be worried about. And that thing fails, and you don't know if it's if you ever take apart those hard drives, the connector is a very little, tiny little piece of silicon with some basic simple chips on there. I mean, it's not doing much work, but it's just the cheapest thing they can possibly stick in there.
You're still okay. It's a SATA connector. You've got your data.
Yeah, it's okay, but I'm saying it's just one little thing that could easily break. It's just a little cheap device that easily comes loose or something breaks when you're plugging a cable in constantly, you know, a couple hundred times, eventually something will break and the pin will break. I mean, it's just slightly more pain in the butt. Again, but it's more mobile. You can bring it to, you know, your aunt's house or whatever and have all your data if something happens. I always suggest, you know, have some sort of static device you keep your storage and then something you can keep offsite, like a big external hard drive you can back up just in case your house floods, like, you know, this guy makes something in your basement. It's always good to back up multiple times. You can never have enough. So, anybody else?
In this configuration and way beyond, I mean, not just like home solo storage stuff, but what I found interesting over the past couple of years, and probably Ike has prompted and provoked this stuff more than anybody, but there's all these funky devices coming out now, like 30-pin IDE to CF cards and stuff like that that's out there that now. And the problem is now CF cards are like few and far between, and, you know, 4 gig of the CF card is like 532 gig SD card. But there's so much of this little gadgetry contraption stuff out there now that just totally overhauls and simplifies stuff. Let me give you an example, actually. 16 gig. So if you have USB on the motherboard.
He's got all his keys on there, guys.
Yeah.
FYI.
It's
always nice
in my
pocket. His SSH keys.
But anyway, 16 gig on here today, and you talk about putting OSs, running off OSs, or images from PSN, FreeNAS, whatever, and with USB in the motherboard, you know, sorry, say what you want about USB connections, but USB in the motherboard, and this is your OS. And this is what's been nice with going on over the past few years to me. It's just like this peripheral gadgetry, which opens up so many things, whether you're dealing with, you know, Soper's Alex boards or, you know, whatever kind of thing. And there's a lot of stuff out there, like Adonix, I think that's one of the sites. All these converters between, you know, IDE to CF or whatever, really makes things fun and interesting, and despite what Henry says, stable.
I mean, if you're just looking to hack around, I mean, I'm not telling everyone desktops is the only way to go. I mean, I build tiny machines and I keep them in the glove boxes of my cars. This is another fun thing I do as well, and I use the same thing you're talking about, a little CF card that runs on the box, that runs a little touch screen, you can do all sorts of fancy things. I mean, I'm just trying to push, it's fun building stuff, build anything. It's either a desktop for your home, it's just kind of an introduction to what you can do with this stuff. Like, well, you know, I only have my iPod, I don't need anything fancy. Like, well, you know, you can back up your music and have it play through your TV, or just to get people's minds, you know, doing more stuff at home, and or even for an office or something, just to keep yourself busy, rather than being stuck with the kids all day, like George.
That's a weird kid.
Anybody else? Comments? Anything? Yeah.
You know, I was going to say, when I first did my box, I did really put on a USB key because I wanted, you know, less power, less noise and all that. But it was becoming more reliable after a few weeks after that we installed.
When you guys do things like the A-time comment, I don't know if you missed the beginning, but it's all about, you know, how you're mounting, you know, the partitions, how you're dealing with, you know, memory disks and so on and so forth. If you're doing it no heavy write system, I mean, heavy writes, but you don't want writes to the flash media.
Right.
There's lots of things you want to do.
Right,
no A-time.
Right.
Maybe no exec, maybe
swap.
Memory disks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's
random disk
that. Linux. So, you know, that kind of thing. That's what you want to be aware of.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
For those that run Gmirror, what are people's preferences with regards to mirroring the actual block devices versus creating partitions first and then mirroring individual partitions? What would be the pros and cons?
As a Gmirror enthusiast, I recommend just doing the whole disk because maintenance becomes a lot simpler. So one command for.
What about, I've heard, like, you could get, say, two different hard disks that are maybe different manufacturers and they don't add up exactly in the number of bytes.
So if you start with the smaller one, it'll use as much the larger one as it needs to match. It's the other way around. If you try to add a smaller one, they'll tell you, no, too bad, it's too small, and you get the return code, not zero.
Okay. What would say down the line, you know, you have a larger disk, and then all you have is a smaller disk, I guess?
you can make a stripe or something hacky out of the small disks if you're in a real hurry, and then add those to the merge. That's a nice thing about stackable geos.
Okay. Cool. Anybody else? Stories? Comments?
Real quick, do you have a preference for doing RAID via CFS or PMR, which would you take?
Yeah. By default, I go UFS and Geom because it's simpler. Disaster recovery, I'm a what happened in the worst case scenario kind of guy. Geom and UFS, the worst case is always easier to deal with.
What about hardware rate works?
I ranked it about that way around.
It was
tough
if you ranked
that before.
Yeah.
I don't know if you touched on that, but both the graphic card and the RAID controller, I think, are PCIe 16, right?
The RAID controller is 8x and the video card is 16. Yeah.
Okay. And so they work well together? From my readings, they say not to mix two 8s or 16s in the same on the same motherboard. Specifically, we're reading about RAID controller.
I didn't read anything about that. I haven't had a problem with this.
Okay.
And maybe it was the case. I guess it would depend on the motherboard. If you buy a piece of the motherboard, I don't see that. I can't imagine that being a common problem, maybe for a particular board. I bought a Gigabyte board. I've used them in the past. They're pretty popular. They work very well.
No, I do.
So, yeah, I mean, that depends on, I guess, what motherboard you're buying or what you read online. I'm not going to read that.
What software do you use on the machine? What OS and what?
On this machine, it was FreeBSD 9 and I set up the hard drive with the RAID controller, and then the file system was ZFS.
Okay.
And then the rest of the talk was talking about setting up via NFS, like a little network share.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Anybody else? So, all right, thank you.